Welcome to Talaterra, a podcast about freelance educators working in natural resource fields and environmental education. Today, my guest is Tim Handley, scientist turned game designer who promotes an understanding of science, nature, and life through play at Mindful Mammoth, a company he founded to create games and puzzles for all ages. What kind of games does Tim create? How does his science background inform what he creates as a game designer? Let's find out. How did you come to be a game designer?
I've always been curious in how things worked, and so I studied physics, and then I studied ecology, both of those helping me understand how the world works. And through that, I came to work for the National Park Service, which was a wonderful thing. It was the job I had wanted to have when I went into graduate school. And so I was a biologist. I got to go out in the field, walk around, see things, touch things, learn about them, come back, analyze the data, find patterns. In many ways, it was great. I loved solving the puzzles. I had also hoped that the things I found would be useful, that people would use this information to help make their lives better, help build a better world, because there's loads of environmental issues that we're facing, like right now, that are going to become worse in the future. And I would hope that we could deal with them sooner rather than later. And that wasn't happening for the most part, because there's this big gap between science and society. And this was a thing that I would talk about with my colleagues. It was a regular lunchtime conversation of, look at the city of Malibu, look at the state of California, people laws are pushing us in ways that are actually unwise and often counterproductive, that are going to make things worse and more costly in the future instead of better. And that's because there's this distrust and this gap. And at the same time, I am a lifelong gamer. I am one of the first people of the gaming generation where I grew up with an Atari and a Nintendo, and video games have been a steady part of my life. And so I thought that I should put these things together. I know science, I know games, I can put them together, and I can make outreach tools that are more informative and engaging than your average book or pamphlet, that can go out through channels that people are used to, and then people will pick them up and play them because it's fun. And in playing them, they will find some of the joy and the excitement and the puzzling and curiosity that I have found in these things too. And so, with these games, I can draw people in and I can help to show them these interesting, useful things that we know. And so that's how I came to do this. I like to solve puzzles. I want to make the world a better place, and I love games. And knowing those things and putting them together, I think, is a powerful tool for both fun and outreach.
In addition to designing games, you teach during the school year, right?
I currently have two teaching jobs, and they sort of change as things do when you're an independent kind of person. But I joined One Spark Academy. It is a small, idealistic, whole kid school in Thousand Oaks. I joined them about 6 years ago. I started out, I was there 2 days during one school year, and then I was there one day a week during the next one, and it's slowly grown. And it's a wonderful little school that is very much interested in whole kid learning and experiential learning and project-based learning and trying to spark kids' interest in the world and help them find what it is that they care about. That's our metaphor of One Spark Academy. And I love the way that our values are aligned. Our principal comes and talks with me once a quarter and says, what classes do you think we ought to teach? And I just pitch things at her, and we are excited about the same things. And so I pitched a class where we just go and explore the parks and the trails around our school. And so I took kids walking barefoot, which is a thing they don't usually do. And so you experience the world in a different way. I pitched a class where we make model rockets, and we built model rockets, and we launched them. I taught a botany class where we went out to the gardens nearby, and we picked flowers and fruits and took them apart and talked about form and function. I'm currently teaching a class called Taking Things Apart, where we literally take things apart, which is a thing that I did as a kid, but many kids don't have that opportunity. And so I gather sewing machines and VCRs, and we take them apart and see what's inside. So it's a wonderful, idealistic, hands-on little school, and so I do teach there. That is one of my regular jobs. I also have recently begun a job teaching at the Art Center College of Design in Pasadena. They have started a game design program. This is the first year, and so I am part of their first wave of staff to help teach these students game design. And I'm really excited about that job, too. It's a wonderful place with committed people who want to make creative things. So I'm a teacher of science to children. I'm a teacher of game design to adults. And then I also make games about science. So it's a pretty full life.
How many games have you designed in the 6 years you've been freelance?
I've made something like 5 or 6 games, and it's kind of a rocky history, as I have learned by doing. So the first game that I developed was called Fire and Flora. It's a card game, it's a tabletop card game about fire ecology, which is basically the things that I was doing and studying when I worked for the National Park Service. And I took that one to Kickstarter and was a little bit naive, and so I was unable to win funding on that, but I've put it aside, and it's a thing I'm thinking about for the future. I've built a game called Fire Tag, which is the live-action version of Fire and Flora, where players put on simple costumes of hats and so on to be a fire, a rainstorm, a grass, or a shrub, and they act out a game, which is also a simulation of fire ecology in California. I've developed a puzzle, which also is unpublished, but it's getting there, I think, which is about ecosystems, again. I've published a small digital game called Sprouts in partnership with a gentleman named Jeff Nuss, and so we've published that on Steam, and it should be coming out on iOS and Android soon, and it's, again, a digital botany puzzle game. And then I have a couple other things in the making. So depending on how you count it, there's 5 or 6 major projects. One is fully published, 2 are close, but I think I'm going to let the physical game sit for a little while and focus on the digital. The publishing model for digital is a lot more straightforward than for physical things. So it's a complicated web of projects there, too. I may back up one moment. I went for, Truth in Advertising, this game, Sprout. What's up with there is this is a partnership between myself and a gentleman named Jeff Nuss. And on this game, he is the game designer and I am the programmer. So most of the things that I have made are solo projects where I am the designer and developer both. And on this one, Jeff is the designer and I am the programmer. And so I want to give him full credit. So the fun that is in the game, I will give him credit for that. It's a beautiful design. And the fact that you can play it and it doesn't crash, I will take credit for that part.
Okay. How do you go from I have an idea to a finished game, a game that people can play without you being there to guide them? I know that you have your physical games and then your digital. How does the process differ between the two?
The process of game design is not that different. Digital tools do let you do things that physical tools can't, and vice versa sometimes too, but the basic process is the same. I actually see it as being pretty similar to the process of science. So in science, what you're doing is you're looking at the world and you're trying to build a model of what's going on from what you see. Because as a scientist, you don't tell the world what it is. You look at the world, you collect data, and you say, I think this is what's going on. And so you build a conceptual model of it could be gravity, it could be a food web, or so on. And when I look at a game, I see models there too. And so there's a set of rules. There's pieces that interact. So there's risk, and you've got armies that interact. There's monopolies, and there's different players that have different properties, and they interact. And so all games are models. So if you're developing a science game, what you do is you take a science model that you think is interesting, and then you build a game around it. You say, okay, here's what's going on in the world, or this is our model of what we think is going on in the world. You know, what role could a player sit in, and how would you make this happen on a tabletop or on a computer? You know, do you need cards? Do you need resources? You know, what do you need? And then you introduce some whimsy and some playfulness because, you know, imagination is a wonderful thing, and we want to spark imaginations. And so there's this balance between the whimsy, the silly, the playfulness that you introduce just as pure imagination. But also there is, I think, playfulness inherent in models. And the world is complicated, interesting stuff that often behaves in ways you don't expect. And that's inherently good fodder for games, because when you play a game, the point is that you don't know the outcome. Each time you play the game, you play with different people, you try different strategies, different stuff happens. And so if you have an interesting model of the world, then in each game, what you're doing is you're messing with the model in different ways. You're making choices that are different. And so you get different surprises, different outcomes each time. So the idea is you pick a model and then you build a game around it. And then there's this evolutionary process where you build the game, you try it out, you share it with people, you get feedback, and you do it again, which is, again, very much like science. So the developing the game is a series of experiments. You try it out. Like, what did I intend for the game to say? Where did I think there was going to be fun? Then what actually happened? And you take the data from yourself and others, and you continually reinvent the game until you find the right balance, a game that has some whimsy and some surprise, some imagination, as well as a model that is inherently surprising as well, that is unpredictable, so that people play the game and they say, oh, I didn't think that that was going to happen. And, oh, that's sort of a neat way that ecosystems, that clouds, that whatever is in your game, that's a neat way that the world works that I didn't know about before. So it's developing a model and then building a game around it and then iterating as a process of experimentation. And then eventually, if you're lucky and you work hard both, you end up with a cool game.
How do you test your games?
Anywhere you can. I mean, that's a big question that lots of people struggle with sometimes. I think the first play tester is always yourself. So you build the game and you try it out and it's your baby. So, you know, you ought to be enjoying it. And if you're not, then you got to fix that. And then once it becomes a thing that you kind of enjoy, then you can bring in your close friends and family, the people that are willing to take a risk and, you know, who love you, and you try it out with them and then you kind of build outwards from there. So where possible, you can, if you're aiming at children, you can find friends with kids, you can find libraries, you can find schools and say, hey, I've got a neat thing, how about I bring it in? You can also try on the web. If it's a digital game, you can sort of make a public call for playtesters. So it sort of starts with you, as you are the first playtester, and then it expands outwards as the game becomes better and more polished.
Do you present at conferences?
Yes, from time to time. So as one example, the International Festival of Independent Games takes place in Los Angeles every October. There's actually other offshoots of this. There's an Indiecade Europe and an Indiecade East, but the Indiecade core is in Los Angeles every October. And so it is the rough analog of the Sundance Festival for movies. And so what happens is game designers submit games, and there are judges and curators who look through the games, find the ones that they think are the most innovative, most interesting, and then invite those people to come and exhibit their games. And so I have exhibited two of my games at Indiecade. I'm actually rather proud of that. So Fire and Floor, this first game that I made about fire ecology in California, I exhibited that at Indiecade, I think 3 years ago. And then Fire Tag, the live action version of that, I shared the next year. And each time you talk about, you know, who plays these games, it's just whoever shows up. You know, it is a festival, and you can buy a ticket for $20 and come in, and it's all the games you can play for a day. And so I exhibited at that festival. And then I have shared a little bit more professionally at other places. So at the Serious Play Conference a couple of years ago, I gave a talk on model-based game design. That's this idea I was pitching to you. If you build a model, you know, a science-based model, and then you build a game around it. I've done the same thing at the Game Level Learn Convention, which happened a month or so ago. I've also presented at the AEOE meetings twice, Association of Environmental and Outdoor Educators. So yeah, it's a variety of places where I share games, I share ideas, sort of as time and money allow.
I went to the California STEAM Conference in the fall, and I think that is an excellent venue for you. It was at the Long Beach Convention Center.
Okay.
And it is targeted to K-12 teachers. And, oh my gosh, the attendance was outrageous for it being, you know, a couple days. There's so many games and curriculum and so many really good discussions that happen there. I think that is an excellent audience for you.
That sounds great. I will put it on my list. It is, in general, hard to find things like that. This intersection of games and education, I think there's lots of low-hanging fruit that is yet to be plucked. It's a fruitful place to be. But it's a place where not very many people are, and I think it's a struggle sometimes to find gatherings of people who are interested in these things and who, you know, are good to share with. So that sounds great. I will put it on my list.
You do what you do so that you have the opportunity to do it again and to share with more people. And ideally, that is how this is all supposed to work, right?
Right.
How do you make what you do a self-sustaining effort?
It is incredibly difficult. So I quit my job with the National Park Service on the idealistic thought that if I build it, they will come. And I did go on to Kickstarter. And I was not successful on Kickstarter because I was over-idealistic. It is incredibly difficult. And so what I do is I actually rely fairly heavily on family and friends. And then I work really hard, and I am patient and persistent. And as I've done this, I've met lots of people that are working in the same space, and almost everybody has this same struggle. It is really hard to get to the point where you can be sustainable and have friends at the same time. So what I do is just, I do what I can. I have these teaching jobs, which I love very much, and I have these games that I have designed. I try to do things on a pay-what-you-can basis, which is a very mixed blessing. For example, I've published this digital game Sprout on Steam, which is a platform for computer games, and I published it for free. And so last time I looked, about a month or so ago, 30,000 people had played the game, and it's a free game, so I received no money from that. But I get a lot of joy in the fact that people have played this game, and it is a portfolio piece. So now when I talk to people, I can say, hey, look, I made this thing, and people have played it. And so that is also, there's a lot of loss leaders in this. It's doing the things that you think need to be done in the way you think they need doing, and hoping that some sort of karma or visibility or respect will slowly accrue to the point that you can actually get money enough to continue. And I'm not yet at that place, honestly. In the 6 years since I left the National Park Service, my net worth has steadily declined. I hope that 2019 will be the year that it turns around. We shall see. Every year I say, am I sure I really want to do this? And so far the answer is yes, but it gets a little bit harder each year as I get a little bit more scared with financial situations. So I hope that this year will be the year it turns around, because I have slowly built up this respect over the last 6 years. So whereas we talked about, I have exhibited games several times at IndieCade, at the International Festival of Independent Games, and I have been a speaker at games and education conferences. So it is not yet sustainable, but I hope that this year will turn it around. I hope that 6 years will be the magic number.
Have you used any of the other platforms? I have seen you on Patreon. And mm-hmm. I have seen you on the teachers platform.
Yeah, I have the Teachers Pay Teachers.
Mm-hmm. Have you used any other platform?
No, those are the two I have focused on. And I think the thing is that marketing and entrepreneurialism are distinct skills that are different than teaching and game design and curriculum design. And it is really hard to be good at all of those at the same time. And I am not. So there are other platforms that I could experiment with, but I don't enjoy doing that, and I'm not good at it. And every time I pick up a new platform, that takes me farther away from the things that I am good at and puts me in danger of losing the skills that I have worked hard to build of teaching and game design and curriculum design. So it's always a little scary to think about that. So far, the Teachers Pay Teachers and Patreon, They are nice things, but they are nothing close to sustainable. Potentially they could be if I was to invest more time in marketing. And I haven't, because I don't like it and because it would take me farther from the things that I'm good at. So it's this very awkward tightrope where I need to put enough time in so I can be sustainable. But if I put too much time in, then I stop being good at the things that are core, the things that I'm actually on these platforms to do. So I don't know how to resolve that yet.
I've read that you help people create games or fun ways of learning. And so who are your clients and what do you help them do?
So for the most part, my clients are sort of an ad hoc bunch. I make games that I think need to be made, and I share them with the people who care to play them. For example, at IndieCade, I brought my game Fire and Flora and I set it up on a table, and then I just said, you know, hey, who would like to play a cool game about plants and fire and ecology and beat up your friends and have a good time? And then people come. And so there's a very ad hoc audience there. As far as more formal clients, I have worked with the National Science Teachers Association. So they have a book series where they are trying to build a series of interactive ebooks that match up with the new next generation science standards. So one book per content standard. And so I worked with them to build a book called Exploring Matter in Space, which is specifically aimed at the fifth grade standard that says fifth graders shall understand that matter is made of particles and then some of the consequences of that fact. So we have worked together on this book. So far, that is the one and only outside contract that I have. But again, this is part of a slow building up of portfolio things. So, you know, I have published Sprouts. I have now published this book with the NSTA. And I'm hoping that as these, you know, as my portfolio grows, that I can gather additional people. It has been very difficult. And I think that's, again, that recruiting issue or the marketing issue.
You've made wonderful progress.
I have. So, I mean, I've worked hard and I am proud of the things that I have done. You know, starting from a position of total idealism, I have made things, and those things have earned the respect of players. They have built fun in the world. They have helped people be more engaged and informed, and it's slowly growing. And I'm glad to say that I have put in both skill and time, and I think it has paid off, and I do find some pride in that. So, yes, thank you.
And, you know, it's also the way of the freelancer is that when you have work that is your entire focus, and then that means you're not looking for more work or other work, and then a project is finished, and then you are, in essence, starting over again. And that is the nature of a freelance work. Have you found that to be the case?
Yes. And again, that's that strange sort of balance where I like doing the game design. This is what I'm good at. This is what I enjoy. And if I only do that, then I will run out of contracts. Whereas if I focus too much on the contracts, then I get contracts, but I don't execute them well. So there's a hard balance that you got to do for both being a builder of things and a maintainer of a business. Yeah.
And what would help you create that balance, do you think?
I think one of two things. I think when I look at the people who have been successful, I think there's both luck and skill. And so there is finding the somewhat like being discovered as a musician or an author. And it is finding a publisher or a speaker, you know, somebody with a voice that is heard and listened to sort of give a shout out and then help you sort of gather recognition and the critical mass to be sustainable. I think there is also partnership. So many of the people that have been successful, they have also not been solo people, but have actually had partnerships with, you know, one person who focuses on creating the content and another person who focuses on creating the business. So, for example, Vlambeer is a relatively famous indie game studio, and it is, in fact, pretty much two people, and one of them creates the games and the other one creates the business, and that's been a very successful partnership. I keep looking around for the silver bullet, and I don't think there's a silver bullet. I think it is a slow, hardworking building of games, building of portfolio, building of respect, building of karma as you go out into the world to talk to people and make things happen. Pretty much all of the opportunities that I have today are like third or fourth hand descendants of things that I started on years ago, and it's just been very, very slowly building.
What does a typical day look like for you?
I'm not sure there is a typical day. I'd say it more varies by season. So what I have is multiple part-time jobs, and some of them are commissions, for example, working for the National Science Teachers Association. Some of them are teaching jobs where I sign a contract to, you know, teach some set of classes for the year. Some of them are my passion projects, the things that I think need to be built, and I just make those when I have time. And so it really depends week by week, month by month, what's going on, what are the deadlines. So some days, you know, I get up at 7 in the morning and I work on curriculum design all day. Some days I get up and I am a teacher. Some days I have time for both and I spend a little time teaching and I spend a little time making things. It varies wildly. Sometimes, you know, I will spend my, you know, have an 8 hours of teaching and then, you know, my editor will say, oh, we've got a problem. Can you help us out? And so then I will stay up late. You know, there's some sort of a deadline and I will kind of try to squeak out the next step for whatever that project is. So it varies wildly. I don't think that there is a standard day.
When you began your freelance profession, what did you believe it was going to be like?
When I began this, I don't think I had many expectations. It was more about hope. It was that I had seen people do this and be successful. There's a small number of big name people who left what they were doing to do what they loved and then met success, sometimes wild success. And I just hoped that somehow it would turn out like that for me. And realistically, I figured it wouldn't, but I felt that it was a thing that I needed to try. For as much as I loved being a scientist and doing science and solving problems, I wanted to do more good in the world. And if I'm totally honest, I think there was a piece of me that was not quite happy as a scientist either. I think if I was to put a label on myself, I think I am maybe an artist, and that's a new kind of a role. I like science. I like puzzles. I like the freedom to make things as well. And as a scientist, I did not have that opportunity. And the things that I do now, I get to do all of those things. I interact with people as a teacher. I am not really a scientist anymore, but I'm very much a puzzle solver. I use my knowledge of science to solve puzzles. For example, you know, being a software designer developing digital games, or you know, trying to find the best way to represent a real-world system inside a game. That's that puzzle solving. But then there's art, too. There's what's fun, what's silly, what stays, what goes. So it's human, and it's technical, and it's creative all at the same time. I was not looking for that, but I found it, and it's turned out really well, and that makes me happy.
Thank you for being a guest on this new show and for sharing your story yet again with me.
May I share one other thought about this project that you're working on?
Of course.
So as I meet other people doing this indie thing who are trying to make what they want to make, whether it be science or art or teaching, I see this. It is hard to get to the sustainability point that you and I have talked about a lot. And there's a real tension between being honest and then being the marketing version of yourself, being the version of yourself that people think you want to be, because there are sort of myths that people like, the solo musician, inventor, movie director who kind of like goes off and does a thing and is successful based on passion. And a lot of people, and there's the Rocky sort of montage where you're running up and down the steps, you're working hard, and then boom, you are successful. And I think sometimes it's not, people hide the struggle of what it is, and that's both good and bad, and that it by not, you don't want to overshare too much information, but at the same time that makes it hard for people who are not in this situation to understand what it's like, and when people don't understand what it's like, then it's also hard to change the culture in a way that helps to enable more innovation. And so I really appreciate that you're doing this project to talk to people and to say what is it like and try and get at, you know, the joy and the struggle both, because I think that's, you know, in the honesty of those stories, there's a lot of value. And for all that some of them are scary and possibly not what listening public may expect, I think it's important to know the good and the bad. And so I hope that these things that you're doing, that you're pulling out, will help everybody, you know, everybody who wants to create things, I hope will be helped to create things in a way that is better and safer and more joyful. So I really appreciate you doing this.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. I'm doing this podcast to give independent educators a voice. You know, I've blogged for so many years, and writing articles and blogging is fine. It's wonderful. But I want it to be more front and center and more out in the open. And so hopefully this medium will help me do that. And thank you so much for trusting me enough to share your story. So thank you very, very much.
Well, you're welcome. And I appreciate the invitation. And I do really appreciate what you're doing. I think this is a good deal for lots of people. And yes, specifically for environmental education, it's a valuable endeavor. And the more visibility that we can give to all the people working in this field, I think the better off everyone will be.
To learn more about Tim's work and to play the Sprout game yourself, visit the show notes for this episode at talaterra.com.